But truly, I suppose we ought to think about that. Where is unrest in the world that might have an economic impact? Where would unrest? So is India seems fairly tolerant at this point. China in unrest. Israel probably, but that would have an impact on global markets because of oil.
Well, just let me just make a comment. I don't think this necessarily relates to war or conflict or anything, but what China has done over the last 6 months, I think anticipating some economic problems, they have basically gone into a program of buying world commodities and really increasing their reserve levels. And in my opinion, that's been an effort to, as they foresaw some shutdowns of factories after the Chinese New Year, a lot of people didn't come back to the cities because there weren't jobs there. And I think they've made a real effort to try to prop up the rural economy to avoid some of the conflict and, distrust of the government. So a lot of these things come into play. And again, I don't think that translates if things get worse there into a war, but there's a lot of those economic decisions being made by governments for agriculture reasons, I think, to try to prop up rural economies. But I wouldn't ever venture to go out and predict another war anywhere.
Perry, I thought it was interesting that you talked about India and the idea that unlike China, where as they became more prosperous, they ate red meat, India unlikely to do that. What impact does that have on ADM's plans for the future for expansion or how they manage demand in India? What kind of product might ADM be looking to move into that marketplace?
We've been involved in India for a little while, but are looking at expansion in crushing there. India is the largest importer of edible oil in the world, and that's an area that we're really looking at and growing. And you look at the growth in population around the world, the Hindu countries like India, Muslim countries that are just not going to eat a lot of beef and pork, and you start looking at them going away from strict vegetarian diets, it really opens the door for poultry, and that's another area that I think we're looking at a little bit longer term, furnishing the protein to go into that poultry market.
And how do you view, I'm going to stay with you, food security or food insecurity issues? So locally grown product as opposed to imported product or exported product from this nation to others. So the question is, would you prefer to have those food supplies developed locally and the plants there or to export out of this country into the other marketplace?
Well, I think the answer to that really lies in productive capacity, where we have the capacity to actually produce. And I think being a global market, I'm not sure it really makes a lot of difference, except that you have to go back to that basic cost of production, where countries have the comparative advantage to produce the product. And then looking at infrastructure, one of the things that we're looking at, if you look at Brazil as an example. And we've anticipated Brazil being the area that would produce most of the soybeans into the future. That's been kind of the mantra the market has gone with. Well, Brazil has really done nothing to increase their infrastructure to be able to move product efficiently over a period of time. And so, and again, the last 3 years they've been basically stable in terms of their area. But if we really need Brazil looking forward to produce those soybeans, we haven't made the investment in infrastructure, or they haven't, or the world hasn't, and that's going to be a real stumbling block, I think, not only just for Brazil, but you look at other parts of the world where infrastructure investment has not been made. We're not keeping up with the projected demand levels that we're going to need to be in the future. And so I think that we're going to come upon a period here, let's say in 5 to 7 years, where that's going to be a major stumbling block in terms of being able to move product and where it's processed.
Does that, and I'm going to stick with you for just a second because I like that issue, does that give the United States a competitive advantage? And what would the U.S. need to update in order to continue to have that infrastructure advantage if that actually
comes
there?
Yeah, I think we have some comparative advantage in terms of just the kind of lands we have, the productive capacity. But we have not done, we're doing the same thing. We've not made the same investments our our river system. We need additional rail. So there's a lot of things that we haven't done to be able to take advantage of that. And then you start looking at, you know, some of the limitations that I think we're in. I mentioned sustainability is really coming into this market in the next 2 to 5 years. Sustainability, environment, what governments, both local and state and national, are willing to let you do in terms of, let's say, livestock production. Are we going to continue to limit the availability of lands to be able to produce livestock? So I think there's some real question marks there, even though our basic structure gives us a comparative advantage.
Bob, Perry, in his discussion, suggested in the future that financing for farmers, market loans, those kinds of things, might come from other parts of the industry as opposed to the banking industry. Some of that happens, we know, in car financing already and equipment financing. Do you see that change on the horizon?
Yeah, that was an interesting comment that Perry made. I had not thought about it before then, so thanks for generating the thought. I would have to give more thought to that, I guess, but it's certainly not out of the realm of a possibility. Now, I think that the issues that go with that are, especially in today's banking environment, there's a lot of different regulations and stipulations and rules coming into play, and maybe rightfully so. But when you think about it, we do have investors, whether they be maybe they're just landowners that really, maybe it's anybody that doesn't know exactly where to put their funds, and maybe to invest in a local operation, whether it be an individual or a partnership farming operation. Why not?
Oh, so you combine kind of a couple of combinations, one from Perry that suggested financing could come from other places other than the banks, and I was thinking just like John Deere Finance,
mm-hmm.
With something that Murray suggested, which was ask your investors that you have landlords maybe to pick up. He suggested land, but you're suggesting that they might invest in the operation? Is that what you just told me?
I've actually seen some father-son situations where that does happen, where
right.
Father has the capability to invest funds, the son does not. Father finances the operation, and it's best return on his investment.
Other questions out here? Yes, sir.
In light of the attack on animal agriculture in this country led by groups like HSUS and PETA, what do you see the influences on grain futures and concerning that movement?
Anybody follow them very much?
Well, we had the recent example of the election in California, Proposition 2.
Right.
Didn't get as much press as Proposition 8, but probably more important overall for agriculture, certainly. But I think that's going to change. I mean, it raises the cost of production, and I think that's going to be something that drifts to the rest of the country eventually. And we are going to continue to see pressure, both from, just from emissions, from smell. There's going to be limitations that's going to make it much more difficult. It's going to make it much more costly for us to produce.
Perry, help me if I get this wrong, but I think Prop 2, if I remember right. And remember, in California, the voters can actually enact their own laws in one form or another, and Prop 2 is one of those things. And I think the year is 2016, that anything that would be caged cannot be raised in California. So they can't feral hogs, they can't raise poultry and chickens in cages, no veal, probably open range sorts of stuff. So that'll change the way Californians. It'll be interesting to see how willing they're to pay for the transportation cost at that point, but it's going to change the way Californians get their meat.
It's not just in California. HSUS has sat down with the Ohio hog producers and said they're coming after them in this year. And in 2010, they want something on the ballot there, too. So it's not just way out west.
And there's a bill in Illinois, too, so it's coming. It's coming. It'll be interesting to see. What other kind of questions do we have out here? I've got two. We'll start over here on this side. Yes, sir.
I'd kind of like to know what your thoughts is concerning the interest rates, futures, land values. What are you predicting in the next 1 to 2 years, especially as we look into the 2009-2010 scenario? Thank you.
Murray, why don't you start on land values?
First of all, on land values, I touched on earlier that there are a lot of counties that, thus far we haven't seen any change. There are some counties that are off 6 to 12%. On a go-forward basis, I know there's some people who think that 2-3 years down the road will be 20-30% lower. Personally, I do not see that. But again, a personal reflection, if you will. We simply have too much demand. And I'll share the exact numbers with you. And from Westchester's point of view, we have $155 million of uninvested capital today trying to find a home in U.S. agriculture. And that's a lot of money. And but we just don't find an adequate number of properties at what we consider to be a reasonable price, if you will, where the rental income will reflect a respectable return. Going on to the interest rate one, I frankly have no idea. I was with some bankers yesterday who strongly think that we will see very little change in interest rates in the next 2-3 years. I also read some things that suggest that we'll have significantly higher interest rates in the next 2-3 years. So that's a real jump ball, to say the least, in my opinion.
Bob, you want to tackle the interest rate as well?
Yeah, I've become a bit of a student, I guess, of interest rates over the years, although I'm sort of putting that aside because you can look at trends and try to figure out historically what rates do. Right now, I think we're in really uncharted waters, and you're exactly right, Murray. These are historically very, very low rates, whether we're talking short-term or extended terms. There's no reason it'll go much lower. Most likely there's a lot more upside potential at this point. But given the state of the economy, we don't see a lot. Our advisors tell us they don't see a lot of movement in rates here probably for the next 12 to 18 months. So I don't think in the year 2009 you have much risk of rates shooting through the roof on you.
Bob, a very pointed question. You spoke some of the seriousness or potential seriousness in regards to the net income for 2009 going forward. If you could, on a scale of 1 to 10, could you rate that seriousness that we're looking at from your banker's perspective?
Really a case-by-case situation, and that was one of my earlier comments, that some people have very low break-even costs on the basis of a bushel of corn and soybeans, but others are much higher, and that is all dependent on input costs, and we certainly do have some control over that. The cash rent is definitely becoming an issue, and just overall debt management. Some people have chosen to carry a higher level of debt than others, and it's at times like these that that'll start to catch up with you. So it's all about cash flow. It's all about how does my debt service relate to my income earning potential. I didn't answer your question. Let's guess at this point 5% of borrowers are in a little bit of a critical situation for 2009. Now, I'm coming from the perspective of a bank that is very solid, has typically tried to attract high quality, high credit, low risk borrowers. So my 5% is actually a little bit high for my particular bank, but there's a lot of banks out there and a lot of money being borrowed. So that's a guess.
Got a question to the panel there. Where is the cheapest farmland in the world that's investment quality, and what the price would be, and could we get our money out of there in 10 years?
First of all, I don't think there is any really cheap farmland anywhere in the world. We've looked at Brazil. We spent a lot of time looking in Brazil in the last year, and when you look at the pitfalls of investing in Brazil, somebody mentioned to me this morning, a large block of Brazilian land at $300 an acre. That might be cheap and it might not be cheap. First of all, keep in mind you face double taxation. You face constantly changing environmental set-aside rules. You face a lot of challenges that us as U.S. farmers can't even begin to comprehend. So, again, frankly, and we look all over the world, we manage and look after about 71,000 acres in Australia, and that stuff is no cheaper than right here in the United States. Go to a country like Chile for a second. In Chile, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 land values are not uncommon at all. So again, I look all over the world and come back to the United States and think this is a pretty good spot.
What do you see if the economy begins to recover and we have supercharged it with more dollars, low interest, et cetera, available credit. If we get into a substantial period of inflation, what do you foresee on land or commodity prices or cost of machinery? What's inflation going to do to agriculture?
I was just asked that question at break, and again, I look on a long-term basis at the change in land values tracking inflation, whatever that may be. Historically, we've exceeded inflation modestly, but I see land values tracking inflation on a go-forward basis.
Since we're on land values, can you talk a little bit about the pitfalls for land in the coming years? Do you think the price of land might tumble? It has periodically. I went back and looked at the USDA numbers yesterday. I think it took a long time in the Great Depression. Actually, the high was in 1920 and didn't get to the lows until 33. 87, a lot of the folks in here will remember that was a low. The high was 81 at that point. Do you see any of you see anything like that for land values in agriculture? We tend to go on a boom and bust cycle. Are we on the bust side? Murray?
Todd, not from my perspective. I think that this time around it's a very different set of circumstances. As I attempted to reflect in those debt-to-asset ratios, agriculture here in the United States is incredibly conservatively levered today. There's a lot of capital trying to find a home in U.S. agriculture today, and I think it's just a different set of circumstances, not like the early 80s where we had 18% plus interest rates and many differing factors that drove us to a bust cycle.
I'll take a little different position on that. I was really pretty surprised at how our land market was driven by the 1031 investor market, and I was even more surprised when they stepped out because those monies were no longer available, how the market has sustained itself. Now, I guess my thought, though, is that as the economy makes a turn and there is a new home for investment dollars, that being the stock market again, that I would feel like there'd be a little less interest in farmland. Having said all of that, though, any economist will tell you that over the years, long term, there has never been any better investment than farmland. So I still believe that will be the case. But I have to believe there's probably a little bit of a setback in market prices here somewhere in the next couple of years.
Perry, do you want to try?
The only thing that I think could creep in here a little bit longer term that may be a real question mark is we have to be concerned about the level of government investment, the nature of the government programs. If we don't have the political will to make the same kind of investments, the direct payments, looks like they don't have the desire to continue with those same levels. That could be the one question mark that creeps in and affects land values over a little bit longer period of time.
Got a question concerning China demand for meat. With the disease in the hog herd going away a little bit and lack of Olympics, would there be a reason to think that future demand would decrease?
In China?
Yes, sir.
We looked last year, China imported almost 38 million tons of soybeans. The early expectations this year, they had a bigger domestic crop, so we thought maybe growth rates would be just stable, and so they could reduce maybe a couple million tons in terms of imports. Now it's looking like with the GDP estimates, they say 8%, other people are saying 5% or less, which is a huge cut from a year ago, that maybe those imports could slide down below 35, 34 million tons, which is an indication to me that consumption of meat is down, because part of that increase in imports up to now has been raising those stocks levels out in the countryside. So indications are that the consumption levels are going down there also as factories have closed, people are staying in the countryside. So I think we are seeing indications of less meat consumption, but it's not, the numbers are not very easy to get a hold of in terms of actual either numbers or consumption levels. Just I think the one meter that we have are the soybean imports, because that's a direct relationship to what they're actually feeding and what consumption would be. So I think you have to watch the import level of beans as probably the one indicator that we have that's a really solid number.
We'll wrap our panel up in just a moment, and we'll let these folks give you a couple of final thoughts on whatever they want to discuss with you, Perry. You'll be the last one to go, so I've got one question for you here while they're thinking about what their final thought might be. Because you're with ADM, and you should have a good handle on what's happened in South America, can you tell us how big or how hurt the corn crop in Argentina was and what impact that really has across the marketplace, how much play they do have in the marketplace, and then also maybe talk about the size of their soybean crop in South America, Brazil, and Argentina both.
Yeah, on the corn crop, Argentina was definitely hurt. I don't know what the final number is going to be, but I think people, you know, basically assume that they're going to export 6 million tons of corn, no more, no less. And so that's kind of a fixed number there. Whatever they have left, they'll have to maybe, you know, we'll look at stocks levels because they have sold less corn than in the past also because of these taxation issues. On the soybean side, you know, Brazil, you know, didn't increase their area, but they've come away with, I think, a fairly decent crop in the late rains in Rio Grande. They're probably going to solidify that crop around 58 million tons. Argentina is still a little bit tough to tell, but the area estimates have come up a little bit. I would say that you're probably looking at a crop there, 42 to 43 million tons. Paraguay had some early problems, but they've planted some second season beans that will probably bring their crop size up to around 5, 5.5. So overall, especially with the additional carry-in that Argentina has, and that crop will eventually come to market, even though short-term it's holding prices up a little bit. But they have a fairly decent crop coming to market, this crop, with the stocks coming in and with the actual crop size probably not being hurt as much as we originally anticipated.
Thank you much. Let's get your final words from each of our panelists. Bob Beesdebert, we'll start with you.
Thank you. I'm very bullish agriculture long-term. I always have been, always will be. I think, though, the tone of my presentation today is one of caution. Cash truly is king. Working capital is the key word. Try to position yourself to where you can put in as much of next year's crop or the crop after that or the crop after that without assistance of the bank. The more the bank has to help you, the less profitable you're probably going to be. Don't make any capital purchases unless you understand whether or not you can pay for it. I don't care if it seems like a good idea or if it seems like an investment that's going to increase in value. Make sure you've got the cash flow to make it work. And those are my thoughts.
Bob Beesdebert is with First Midwest Bank. Murray Weiss is with Westchester Group. Murray?
First of all, I fully agree with Bob's comments there. But just a couple thoughts in passing, and I think we're going to see and hear more about this in coming years. But from Westchester's perspective, it started in 2008, and it accelerated in 2009. And I don't want to discuss the details of it because it's a process in motion, if you will, or an experiment at this stage. But we have moved in 2009 somewhere between 60 and 75% of our cash rent leases to a base floor rent lease, and then there potentially will be an additional payment made based upon commodity prices and commodity prices only. And again, I think that there will be a major transition in the Midwest, going back to some of Bob's comments during his formal presentation relevant to his thoughts on cash rent. So I think we'll see a lot of changes in this area. But lastly, I want to share a quick story for you. We manage agricultural assets for a lot of individuals, but we also manage for 5 major pension funds. We were reporting the results in late January to our second smallest, I repeat, second smallest pension fund. And the chief investment officer, who was on the other end of the conference call, we reported to him, and he's a personal friend of mine, a great guy. I have lunch with him next week, but he usually doesn't have a lot of nice things to say. He usually just kind of gets in your face and says, you know, why didn't this do a little better? At the end of the presentation, to my great shock, he said to us that I would like to congratulate you on the ag results that you're reporting to us for 2008. You are probably the only asset management firm that will be reporting to us for 2008 that will have positive numbers. Now, keep in mind on my onset, I said he's the second smallest pension fund that we manage for. He went on to say that in 2008, he had lost his pension fund $6.1 billion. And again, they're looking at agriculture as a very conservative, very long-term place to be for a portion of their assets.
Thank you very much, Murray. Perry Dixon, your final comments, please.
Just a couple of things that I've already touched on. Sustainability, I think, is something we really need to watch, how the legislation comes out this year in terms of how it impacts agriculture. Infrastructure, both here in the U.S. and abroad, I think is going to be really important as we look at a bigger demand and trying to move this product. And then the last thing I think we need to really be aware of is how the world is starting to view trade. And we're starting with the shortfall in crops this last year. You saw a lot of countries put restrictions on in terms of what could be exported. I think that's a real danger for this market. If we start to close our borders, we start to restrict trade, we start to put increased tariffs to protect domestic industries, I think that's going to be a real big concern moving forward here, and it's something we really have to watch.
Give these folks a nice round of applause.